the sixth case, the United States versus Rand. Ms. Connor?
May it please the court, I am Carrie Connor and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Rand. Though we had a very elongated sentencing in this matter, I'm here on the sole issue of the court's order of restitution. And in this case, I believe that we must start with the statute itself. And Your Honor, that's 3663A, the mandatory restitution to victims of certain crimes. Our first argument in this case, Your Honors, is that in fact the court's overall restitution order was far broader than the statute permits the court to impose. And specifically, I'd cite the court to the language in the statute that provides that any person directly harmed by the, quote, defendant's criminal conduct in the course of the scheme, conspiracy, or pattern is therefore available to the court for restitution. The problem in this case, Your Honors, is that the $57,000 order of restitution encompassed far more than the defendant's criminal conduct in this case. And specifically, I would cite the court to $7,241.76 worth of restitution that is clearly, even on this record, outside the count of conviction and the defendant's conduct. Specifically, Your Honor.
The conduct was participating in a conspiracy, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Aren't these people harmed by that, by the conspiracy?
Well, Your Honor, that is the crux of the $7,200 that I'm speaking of. The indictment in this case, count one of which my client pled to, alleged a conspiracy, the manner and means of which was the theft of names and information from the Gary school system, and in essence, the use of that information to obtain credit and the use of that credit. Of those names, of that $7,241.76 that I've cited to the court, including Thomas Allen, Wilbur Beeks, Denny Merck, Grace Phillips, Andrea Peden, Rosalio Arguin, all of those people, or at least the record does not indicate that any of those people were part of the Gary school system. And therefore, the clear issue that arose in this case and came up over and over again was that the government wanted to define the conspiracy in this case as a conspiracy to commit fraud in the broad sense without any focus at all on what, in fact, was Daniel Rand's agreement in this case. We are not arguing that victims of fraud by Daniel Rand are not entitled to restitution. In fact, Daniel Rand admitted $12,594.90 worth of criminal activity, some of which is clearly arguably outside of the conspiracy as defined by the count of conviction. However, because defendant's criminal conduct in the statute could be read more broadly to encompass any of his illegal conduct, he did admit and does not contest paying restitution to those victims. But the initial and ultimate issue in this case is what is the count of conviction for which the court is authorized to order restitution. And we have only the count of conviction as reflected in count one of the conspiracy as charged by the government. And that is a
$7,000 figure. What is that?
That $7,000 figure is the amount of restitution attributable to each of those victims that I've listed. It also is in our brief, Your Honor, in a footnote that, in fact, those people were not shown to be employees of the Gary school system, and therefore they are clearly outside the scope of count
what
one.
What was the conduct that harmed them?
The conduct that was alleged to have harmed them was the use of credit in their name. As a secondary issue, Your Honor, it was not.
Wasn't that done by your client? Wasn't he responsible for that harm?
No, he was not, Your Honor. We contested those allegations and the government was never established that, in fact, Daniel Rand committed those illegal acts. So as an initial matter, that $7,241.76 worth of restitution was clearly outside the court's discretion to impose restitution. What the court...
Your contention is the harm was caused by some other conspirator? Is that what you're claiming?
Your Honor, our claim is that our client was not responsible for it. The government did not establish who, in fact, committed that fraud. What the government did in this case is to basically throw out 9 addresses and say to the district court that any fraud which the government could connect up to that address, which was done actually by the probation department in the form of reviewing files on whether these addresses were used or somehow attached to these accounts, the district court even rejected that, Your Honor, and narrowed the field down to 4 addresses. Those 3 of those addresses was 7311, which was a Chicago address that was shown to have belonged to my client's sister, Christopher Rand, at one time. Another address, 101 East 41st, which is a residence that Jeanette Elzey, also my client's sister, lived at. And 7311, which was found to be, I'm sorry, I repeated the wrong, 1132 Polk, which was found to be another sister of my client's. In page 27 and 28 of our addendum, Your Honors, I cite the court to that portion of the transcript.
What's this footnote of yours you're talking about with the 7,000 odd in it?
Oh, I'm sorry.
I don't see any footnote.
It's footnote 8 on page 10 of our brief. And it's discussed on that page that the $7,241.76 of the restitution order goes to the several individuals.
Where is
which
that figure? I don't understand.
You don't see the figure,
no.
Sir?
What footnote?
It's footnote 8 on page 10
there's
of
no
appellant's
such,
opening
no
brief.
Such figure there.
I beg your pardon?
1600, 1000, 1284, 979, 920. Where is the 7,000 figure?
Your Honor, I apologize. It appears that the footnote was not complete. However, whether we take the 7,000 or we add up the figures that are included in the footnote, it is clear that numerous alleged victims were said to have been included in the conspiracy, which were not part of the conspiracy by the very nature of the allegation of the government. In addition to that, Your Honor, I would...
Were victims of the conspiracy?
That, yes, as the count of conviction. They are not Gary School employees. The entire conspiracy, initially as defined by the indictment, was not defined more specifically by the government at any point. And there clearly were included, as reflected in the probation report, victims of fraud who were said to be, my client was said to be held liable for because of addresses that the district court found there was information to indicate my client had a connection to them. But ultimately, Your Honors, even if we look to what the conspiracy and to the count of conviction, the issue is very much like the case cited by the government in Martin. And that is that the government has not proven beyond those victims that my client has admitted to, the 12,000 in some sense worth of victims, that in fact these allegations of fraud had anything whatsoever to do with the conspiracy that my client participated in. And it's extremely significant in this case that the evidence was that Jeanette Elzey, who was a janitor in the Gary school system, had stolen names from the Gary school system and had used them. My client admitted to several of those cases using names that had been provided to him. The issue becomes Jeanette Elzey lived at 101 East 41st Street. The court included in its restitution order against Mr. Rand any and every allegation of fraud that came back to 101 East 41st Street, without any finding and without any evidence that, in fact, those acts of fraud had any connection to Daniel Rand whatsoever. The same was done with 7311, and the same was done with 1132. Also, and I did note it in my brief, the court found evidence based on what Jeanette Elsey and Velma Rand, his sisters, had said to indicate that my client was somehow responsible for fraud committed against the Chester Williams because he lived on Jefferson Street, and my client...
101st, according to your opponent, 101st East 41st, 101 East 41st was the resident of his sister.
Yes, my time is up. May I?
And a number of fraudulent credit cards listing him as an authorized user were obtained with that address. Are you suggesting it was done without his knowledge?
Your Honor, we admitted to a number of credit cards. There were some in which his name came up as an authorized user, which we contested. Yes.
Your position, though, is that the people listed in footnote 8 should be excluded.
Absolutely.
That's your. Otherwise, everything is all right.
No, it is not.
What else is the problem?
The government has not provided any factual evidence to connect any of the allegations made that show up in the probation report, and which were included as relevant conduct in restitution, that they have any connection to a conspiracy which my client joined. Therefore, as the government cited in United States versus Martin, this court must, at a minimum, remand for a hearing from the district court to determine whether, in fact, those fraud allegations are part of a conspiracy which my client joined. Nowhere in the record did the government, did the court make that finding.
Thank you, John. Ms. Houston.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Toy Denise Houston. I'm an assistant United States attorney for the Northern District of Indiana. The first thing I'd like to note is that counsel focuses on one portion of count one of the indictment. If you go through the overt acts of the indictment, all of the victims to whom her client pled guilty are delineated in the indictment. Larry Alexander, Lena Nelson, Catherine Wright, Sheila Comer. All of these individuals are identified in the overt acts of the indictment to which the defendant pled guilty. This defendant's sole argument is that the district court can only consider the conduct to which he admits. Basically, it's a pick-and-choose theory. I'm picking the victims to whom I want the court to consider and nothing else. Defense counsel argues that there was no evidence presented at the sentencing hearing.
Were they listed in the indictment? Does their name appear in the indictment?
Some of those individuals do, Your Honor. And as the government argued at the sentencing hearing, we're not required to list every overt act. I think it was page 8 of her...
Page 10. Page 10. Footnote 8, yeah.
The only one I believe, Your Honor, and I can't say for sure, would be Mr. Allen. But the others, I could say that they were not identified in the indictment. However, with respect to Denny Merck, during the course, just as by way of history, if the court can tell that the defendant pled guilty on March 3rd of 2003, between court-ordered hearings, oral arguments, sentencing submissions, meetings that were ordered between the defense counsel, government, and probation, the defendant was eventually sentenced in February of 2004. During the course of this, the defendant made admissions as to others. If you look at his change of plea hearing, this is what's ironic about what counsel's saying. She's saying that we didn't present any evidence with his connection to the 1132 address in Gary, Indiana, which was his sister, Velma Rand. The defendant, during his own state, on his January 18, 2002 statement, and during the change of plea hearing, acknowledged the 101 East 41st Avenue address in Gary. He acknowledged the 1132 Polk Street address in Gary. He acknowledged the 7311 South Evans Street address in Chicago, Illinois. All three of these addresses associated with his sisters. So he acknowledged this. In fact, during his change of plea hearing, the district court judge had to keep asking him repeatedly about Catherine Wright. And over the course of this nearly one-year sentencing hearing, he changed his opinion as to which things he would acknowledge with respect to individual victims. The government would dispute the argument and disputed this at the sentencing hearing that the government did not accumulate this information. We did have this information. The court had ordered both the district court, both the defense attorney, government, and probation to meet with respect to this, and we did repeatedly. Defense counsel, as I said, sole argument is that the court should only take into consideration what the defendant wants to admit to. She's ignoring the McIntosh case, which states that the court may accept the PSI as true unless the defendant presents some evidence more than mere denials questioning the PSR's accuracy. In this case, the court didn't even agree with probation or the government for the full $90,000-plus in restitution. It reduced it to the $57,000 amount. But clearly, under McIntosh, the court was allowed to take portions of the PSI and rely on it. All they did throughout the entire sentencing is present speculation and denials. And again, right before this court is saying that there's no connection between this defendant and these three addresses. The court clearly made a record that there is a connection between these three addresses, not simply because they were his sisters, but because the defendant, during the change of plea hearing, acknowledged that. These addresses. He acknowledged in his January 18, 2002 statement that his sister, Jeanette Elsie, who was convicted by jury, would contact him to give him these names and say, you are better at this at changing up the addresses. So she utilized his skills in fraud to assist her in this.
Can I ask you why it took a year for a sentencing hearing?
Because each time we came before the court, the defendant's counsel advised the court that the government had not presented enough evidence to support. During the course of the hearing, the government submitted three binders of sentencing exhibits to the district court relating to not only the victims, their affidavits, the business affidavits and declarations of losses, what's called Face the Nation, which what law enforcement does is that they run these addresses, and the victims' names popped up under addresses, 101 East 41st Avenue, 7311 South Evans, and 1132 Polk Street. Their names popped up under these addresses based upon the Faces of Nation run through law enforcement. And their affidavits clearly stated they never resided at any of these addresses. It is the government's position that the court took a conservative position and only attributed that amount to the defendant. In fact, the court didn't consider the losses at 4189 Harrison Street, and the defendant, during his change of plea hearing, while under oath, told the court, I live there. But the court didn't even take that into consideration. These are just unsubstantiated statements. They're not enough to undermine our proof of loss. She's throwing up, again, mere speculation with these three binders. There were several witnesses who testified. The court is allowed to take in consideration evidence that was presented at the jury trial of the co-defendant. There's no dispute that the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act is applicable, and defense counsel keeps citing only portions of that act. It says that the victim means a person directly and proximately harmed as a result of the commission of an offense for which restitution may be ordered, including in the case of an offense that involves as an element a scheme, conspiracy, or pattern of criminal activity, any person directly harmed by the defendant's criminal conduct in the course of the scheme, conspiracy, or pattern. It's the government's position that also that that she's talking about there's evidence of uncharged or related conduct. Under the Ojomo case, that may be considered. It's a case that the government cited at the sentencing hearing. Both counsel and government rely on the Obasohan case, which effectively amended a Huey, which again said that you can include criminal conduct in the course of a conspiracy. It's the government's position that the court correctly utilized the provisions of the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act, that the court correctly utilized the provisions of the Victim Witness Protection Act, and that the court correctly determined and did not abuse its discretion in determining the amount of restitution, and that the case law in this circuit is clear that there is joint and several liability. So despite what counsel says in her reply brief that we did not respond to some of her arguments, the reason it was not necessary to respond is because the government didn't disagree with what those cases stand for. Those cases stand for what the standard of review is. Those cases stand for joint and several liability. So it's the government's position that this should be denied.
How many appearances did it take over the year to have this sentencing concluded?
In the hearings, there were, including the change of plea hearing, there were four actual hearings, one on November 6, 2003, one on January 8, 2004, one on February 19, 2004, and then the final sentencing was February 26, 2004. Thank During the course of this, the parties were required to meet to review all of the documents collected by both probation and the government.
Thank you, Ms. Houston. Ms. Connor, you have your time has expired, but you may have 1 minute if you wish to rebut.
As this court may be fully aware from review of the record, this was a highly contested sentencing. And I do agree with the government that the reason it was continued several times is that the defendant continued to contest throughout the year that, in fact, the government had not established the connection between my client and the numerous fraudulent allegations that they were making. In our brief, we admit the connection to 1132 being Velma Rand's residence and that my client lived at that residence for a short time. 101 East 41st Street, Jeanette Elsie's address. We admit that completely. We admit 7311 was another sister's address. The issue in this case is not whether there was some connection between my client and the addresses, but whether the numerous fraudulent accounts that somehow come back to those addresses at no specific time given in this record, if that alone is sufficient to argue that it is part of a conspiracy which my client joined. And we assert that it is not.
Thank you, Connor. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will stand in recess.